In this episode, part two of our conversation with author and principal John Marsden, we'll be talking about how children are not just sweet and innocent and how modern society tends to idealise children and how this can damage them.
Welcome to Raising Wildlings, a podcast about parenting, alternative education, and stepping into the wilderness, however that looks, with your family.
Each week, we'll be interviewing experts that truly inspire us to answer your parenting and education questions. We'll also be sharing stories from some incredible families that took the leap and are taking the road less travelled.
We're your hosts, Vicky and Nikki from Wildlings Forest School. Pop in your headphones, settle in, and join us on this next adventure.
Hello and welcome to the Raising Wildlings podcast. I'm your host, Nikki Farrell. This episode of the Raising Wildlings podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Fun Fables podcast. Fun Fables is a great little podcast for kids with stories such as The Three Little Pigs, Jack and the Beanstalk, and The Gingerbread Man, and they're retold in a very fun and entertaining way. Just search for Fun Fables, Stories for Kids on your favourite podcast app or click the link in the show description. We have absolutely loved seeing your takeaway moments and highlights of the show on our socials, so don't forget to subscribe or follow us on your social media platform of choice and tag us on Instagram so that we can share the love. We absolutely love sharing your posts. Now, in our last episode, part one of our conversation with one of Australia's favourite authors and principal, John Marsden, we spoke about his school, Candlebark, and how he would change the education system if he could. This week, we chat about childhood, how we idealise children and how this sets teenagers up to fail and not want to grow up. We chat about how teenagers need to metaphorically kill their parents to become adults. We talk about the importance of real-world experiences in education, ineffectual parenting practices, and how it might be a good idea for Australia to one day have an education minister that has actually worked in the education industry. Mind-blowing thought, isn't it? So join us now as I continue my conversation with John. That brings me to another point that I loved in The Art of Growing Up. Teenagers, they get a horrific rap. And I love them. I love teenagers. I love their honesty. I love that they're curious still. They're still curious, but they hold us accountable. That's what I love about them. But we've got a lot of teenagers now saying that they don't want to grow up. You know, I don't want to become an adult. It's scary out there and I just want to stay a child. And that's the worst kind of man I've ever met is a man that's never grown up. How can we go about making adulthood more appealing for these teenagers coming through?
Yeah, we give it a very bad press ourselves for coming home and complaining all night about how awful our day has been. And so by the time we finish complaining about the tax assessment and our colleagues at work and about the customers at work and about the public transport system and about the weather and the fact that we're not earning a big enough salary, then I think kids hearing that day after day, year after year, probably do form a pretty negative impression of what adult life is like. And they think of it as a bit of a nightmare. It's just something that's full of privation, full of suffering, full of anxiety. And so it does make it a less appealing prospect for them. And certainly I know teachers do the same thing with teaching. Teachers will tell classes all day long, "Oh, it's a terrible job, don't ever become a teacher. Oh my God, the work you've got to do."
And Saturday marking instead of at the footy.
And the department's brought in these new ridiculous regulations and now we have to spend 3.5 days doing this and this. And so after hearing that for 13 years, our best and brightest kids may not choose to go into teaching. They may decide that there's something more glamorous out there that might be a little more worthwhile. And I think that's a shame because I've tried quite a few different jobs and teaching for one that's been easily the most rewarding and the most engaging and the most the one that's allowed the most creativity. Probably the funniest too. There's plenty of very funny moments in teaching.
I can't wait for your – I feel like you've written a book for our generation of every important phase, but I can't wait till you get to your end of your teaching career and you've got your – I want to see a book of quotes of all the things that you haven't been able to publish while you're a teacher.
Well, The Art of Growing Up took a long time to write because I took some sort of courage because I knew I was going to. And I think somehow being – principal for 15 years, it's inured me to criticism to a large extent. 15 years ago, if people criticised my books or anything else, I would feel pretty awful and I'd go into quite a downslide for a period of time, which might only be a few hours, but could last for a long time. Mm-hmm. But over the last 15 years, I've just gradually acquired some sort of immunity. And I think it's because, as a principal, you're copying it all the time from every direction.
All the time.
You're dealing with really unhelpful bureaucrats and really ignorant politicians, because ministers for education, who are in charge of education, uniformly know nothing about it. And if you look at this, I say that with some after a lot of research, because if you look at their CVs, since Federation, we have never had anyone who knows anyone about anything about education holding the portfolio.
It drives me nuts. Putting someone like Abbott in charge of the women's division.
Yep, what a great appointment that was.
Oh, my gosh.
Who made that appointment, by the way? I think it was Tony Abbott, I think.
I think it might have been himself, he himself.
Yeah, he chose himself for the job. So the previous Minister for Education was an expert in the Murray-Darling irrigation system. That was his background. And the current minister was a farmhand and then an economic advisor and a political consultant or something. Mm. And now suddenly he's in charge of education. He's never shown any interest in it. He knows nothing about it. Neither did his predecessor. Neither did the rock singer Greeny before him. Neither did the barrister, the lawyer who was a specialist in industrial relations. So whether it's Peter Garrett or Julia Gillard or the current minister or a previous minister, Senator Birmingham, we're dealing with amateurs who are blundering around trying to sound as though they're omniscient when they just know nothing.
Nothing. And, you know, you would see the cycles that come through and we're scrapping this and we're adding this. And well, we were doing that 10 years ago. Thanks for giving me a new name and making me do that training for another 2 weeks of my time. But
they bring out a new curriculum every 5 to 10 years, and we're meant to spend months studying it and enacting it, but in fact it doesn't change anything in the long term. Things change in the classroom because of the evolution of society. They don't change because the education department has put out a new document, although that document may reflect some of the things that are happening in society. But when we're told that we need to, when we're told by the Department of Education that we need to have more time and effort invested in teaching the history of Indigenous Australians, then we were doing that anyway because there was a societal understanding that that had to happen and it must happen, and we were already tuning into that and implementing that. So the document always comes along after the societal change, the cultural change is happening. It's always too late to be of any interest.
How do you go with our lovely Australian curriculum currently? How do you go squeezing that dry content in at Candlebark? Look at my biases showing through there.
Yeah, well, we ignore it. I mean, we tick every box that the education department wants us to tick. Mm-hmm. And I can knock off a policy document now in 10 to 30 minutes, I suppose. Nice. And they get filed, they get sent to the department, they get posted on the website, they get filed, no one ever looks at them again.
That's such a waste of teachers' time, isn't it?
Completely. Mm. Yep. It's like writing reports, also a waste of teachers' time. Oh. They're computer generated, so there's no author in the reports, there's no sense of an author, a real person, a human being having written the report. And the parents who care about their children already know what's happening at school with them. And the parents who don't care aren't going to read the reports anyway. So
no, you can't get them to a parent-teacher interview, can you?
No, it's another meaningless exercise.
Isn't it?
Yeah. You did ask me some time back for three things that I would change, and the third thing would be something I've already talked about, which is to reintroduce first-hand experiences to school. Because we've now got a society where teachers are scared to take kids across the road to the park because they've filled in all the forms, they haven't rung the insurance broker to check that they're covered, they haven't got signed notes from all the parents giving permission, and so they stay in the classroom because that's the easiest thing to do, and that seems to them like the only option, which is a very sad state of affairs.
We had a big issue at my last school where if an excursion was going to cost over $20, essentially it was scrapped because, you know, our parents, a lot of our parents couldn't afford that. And I thought, they don't need to be that expensive. Like you said, why can't I just take my class across the road? But unless at our school it ticked, couldn't just tick my English curriculum, it had to tick so many curriculum boxes for me to take this class out. Like I said, the hours that we do to get children outside, it's infuriating.
Yeah, and as a teacher I was pretty lawless in many ways, but
I can't imagine.
I don't know whether I'd risk it nowadays, but I mean, one of the most powerful excursions I ever did was to take a group of year 10 students to an abattoir.
But nice.
It was out of boarding school, so I knew that the parents were at a safe distance. They weren't going to get in the way.
And, well, most of them were probably farm background as well than if they were boarding.
True, yeah, they were. And but I also knew that if I asked the school authorities, they would say no. It was a very negative school where they just said no to everything.
Yeah.
So I went down to the maintenance department and I said, I want to book a bus for tomorrow. And they were like, fine. They just assumed that I had permission. And I have a bus license and plenty of experience driving trucks and buses. And when the kids arrived for their double English, I said, we're going on an excursion, hop on the bus. And so we drove out of the school gates down the road to an abattoir where I'd arranged with the owner the day before to bring a group of students. And as we drove through the gates of the abattoir, was their realization that that's where we were going, because I deliberately not told them, because we were studying a novel where kids unexpectedly come across large animals being killed and they are shocked and traumatized by it. And my class was so apathetic about this novel, I thought, well, I'll give them a first-hand experience of what it's like. So we went on the tour and only three kids finished the tour, because the rest were sitting outside with their heads between their knees, green in the face and trying not to throw up. Three of them became vegetarians.
I was just going to ask what the ratio was that you turned veggie in that trip.
Yeah, it was so, I don't know whether I'd do it again, because I was a bit horrified by the extent of the their reactions. But they were really pleased that we'd done it and they were really positive about it. But on the way back to school, I said to them, I'd be grateful if you didn't mention this excuse to the senior teachers at the school. I said, by all means, talk to your parents about it, that's fine, but it would be nice if you didn't mention it to any of the administrators, because they didn't actually know that we were doing it. And I don't think anyone ever did. No one ever mentioned it to me. There was never any comeback from the administration. When you mentioned before a kid who'd never been, what was the example you gave?
Climbing trees, was that one?
I'd like to know how many kids have never been outside the city in Australia. Significant number who have not left the suburbs.
Yeah, well, that's true. When I was working in outdoor rec in a previous lifetime, like you said, 30 careers ago, same thing. We took kids out from the city, inner city, low socioeconomic schools, and they'd never seen the stars. And this is in Adelaide. You know, we're not talking Hong Kong.
Yeah, the Henry Lawson Banjo Patterson Australia is unknown to a huge number of city kids and suburban kids. And that seems bizarre to me. It seems grotesque.
I've been really shocked in our work at Wildlings, the amount of children that have never, and this is from their mouths, and look, I know children lie and I know children tell great stories too, so, but that, you know, they've never felt mud before and we're worried that it wouldn't wash off. That's come out of a year two child's mouth. They've never been into a forest. I said, what do you mean you've never been into a forest? He said, I've never been and stood in amongst trees this big anywhere in my life before. On the Sunshine Coast, but we're surrounded by it. You can't have left your house.
You're surrounded by shopping malls, and that's where most excursions are nowadays. Most kids' lives revolve around the school, the home, and the shopping mall.
And the sport grounds.
Yeah, just in many areas, that's true too. But the idea of doing anything adventurous and having first-hand interactions with the natural world is unknown to them, which leads to all kinds of misapprehensions. So for one thing, many people believe that nature is a place of peace and serenity and beauty, which it is, but it's also full of violence and, savagery. And when you see birds eating insects or insects eating each other or animals eating birds, then, yeah, you realise that there's a dark, what we would term a dark side to it. That's the natural world. That's the way it is. And so we shouldn't be making value judgments about it.
No, let's talk about that, the dark and the light and the sweet and innocent. In The Art of Growing Up, you talk about how children are not sweet and innocent. Well, you know, they can be, but they're not all sweet and innocent, and how we idealize and sexualize children as well. Can you talk about that for us a bit? Because I think this is really important.
Yeah, we have this, I could talk for a long time about this, but we have this desire to find a world which is pristine, which is perfect, which is serene, which is beautiful and sweet. And we look for it anywhere and everywhere. And some people look for it in revivalist Christian movements, and some look for it in Buddhist temples or monasteries. Some look for it in courses they might do at Byron Bay or somewhere. Some look for it in John Kennedy's White House back in the early 60s. And many people look for it in the world of nature, as I was saying, but also many people look for it in the world of childhood. So they construct this artificial understanding of childhood, that children are sweet, gorgeous, innocent, cute, etc., 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 ignoring the fact that just like adults, children will have times when they are cruel, greedy, selfish, dishonest, and they will also have times when they are kind, generous, loving, caring, and hardworking too. So we need to see things as they really are, because if we construct this false idea about children, every time they violate that false idea, we'll be furious. So if a child swears, I still feel uncomfortable when a child swears, but I know that's not logical, because there's really nothing worse with an 8-year-old swearing than with an 18-year-old swearing. No. It's just that the 8-year-old is violating my idea of what a child should know about, what they should have learnt in their lives. And so I'm shocked when they do it. But I'm less shocked when they are greedy or dishonest or cruel or whatever, because I've seen enough of children to know that, yeah, they all have that ability and that propensity at times, just as I do. Okay. I can be greedy and cruel and dishonest and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's true of any age group. Absolutely. So if we're going to generalize about an age group, we should generalize about other age groups too, and say that all 40-year-olds are sweet, gorgeous, cuddly and so on. But we don't do that. It's reserved exclusively for children, which leads to a second problem, which is that when you reach the end of childhood, you've got to go down. There's no improvement on being sweet, gorgeous and cuddly and cute and everything else. It's got to be a downhill path, which means that we artificially construct adolescence as a time of distress and disturbance, and imagine that all adolescents are enraged or lazy or drug addicted, incompetent or illiterate or whatever. And yeah, they can be all of those things, just as we all can. Mm-hmm. So again, the reality of adolescence is you get the full range of behaviours, as you do with children, as you do with adults. Even people in the nursing home can be cruel and selfish and greedy and dishonest and everything else. We had a when we had trips to nursing homes here with little kids, one of them came back and complained he was playing, I don't remember whether it was Happy Families or Uno, with a lady who was in her 90s, and she furiously accused him of cheating in this game of cards, which I don't think he was, and he was quite upset. She'd regressed to a childlike state, and that's how she saw the world and how she saw what was happening at the time.
I think it's so important for our children to see that and to understand that that's what happens, because, you know, we separate our children, we separate our elderly. Who the hell are we? Who are they socialising with?
Yeah, we effectively lock the elderly away. They put nursing homes, which I call waiting rooms for death, because they simply have no other function. And there seems to be a belief that these people have nothing to contribute to society. So in other societies, they might still be holding the baby in their laps while they sit near the fire or whatever. They might be helping stir the soup as it's cooking. So they still have functions. They still have roles. They still have an important place to play, even though it might be less dramatic or spectacular than when they were middle-aged or younger. But we don't seem to have any role for many old people, and we consign them to an awful fate because of that. Yeah, we're a society that's gotten very confused and lost. And I think one of the major confusions in dealing with young people is the belief that to protect them from physical injury and death, physical death, is so important that everything else has to be subordinated to that. So they're not allowed to go on swings anymore. Most playgrounds are getting rid of the swings. They're not allowed to climb trees. They're not allowed to go into the bush. They're not allowed because they might get bitten by a snake or a tree might fall on them. They're not allowed to go out in the rain because they might get, I don't know, pneumonia or something. At our school, we ignore the weather, and the kids ignore it too. They don't care whether it's raining, snowing or sunny. They just play regardless, and we have lots of towels, old towels, that they can dry off with if they need to. And some of them have a change of clothes if they want to bring them to school. They can use those. But honestly, the kids don't care what the weather's like. So to me, that's a much healthier attitude than this unfortunate one we've got into, because by protecting them from physical injury and physical death, we're condemning them to an emotional death and a spiritual death and a social death, which is in its own way as awful as a physical injury.
Well, there's just this fear of the world. They're fearful. You know, and I don't want to generalize. I don't want to generalize an entire generation, but, you know, in our last cohort of students that I had, we only had 18. It was a English communication class, and six of them were diagnosed with this, that or the other, anxiety and depression mainly. And I'm not a psych, but I would have diagnosed another three. So that's half of my cohort. You know, if that's not telling about, you know, something's going on. And, you know, we can't just blame education, can't just blame parenting, but something's got to change because it's not okay.
Yeah, I use the word pandemic to describe anxiety among young people, and it has just blasted across the face of the Western world in the last generation. So we had this era where eating disorders were almost the main manifestation of depression, and then we had self-harming, and now we have panic attacks. And the numbers have grown to such an extent that, like you've just described, we're seeing those kinds of numbers among the older kids who we admit to the school in year 7 or 10 or 12 or whatever. They're so ridden with these disorders that they're unable to function. They literally stay at home, many of them. It's very hard to get them out of the house to go to school. Many of them are getting psychological care, but often that's in short supply.
Oh, it is. And
often the people who practice it are not people who I really have any confidence in, because some of them are not really good at what they're doing, which makes it very difficult to recommend psychologists or psychiatrists or counsellors.
So let's talk about that. I loved this, really resonated again as well, and I think, and I'm not sure why, because perhaps because we've all been there at some point, perhaps because even as a teacher, you know, we see it happen quite regularly. But talk about the concept of teenagers having to metaphorically kill their parents.
Yeah, it's something I became aware of teaching boys in secondary school, that time and time again they would tell me a story about something that had happened, and I started to think, I've heard this story 12 times in the last 16 weeks. But the details would vary. So it might be that there was one story that a woman told me, how her son and husband had been playing golf or tennis on the tennis court at the back of the house. And after an hour or so, she saw a tennis racket come flying through the air and land in the bushes. And then a minute later, her husband came storming through the house and raged down the corridor and into the bedroom, slamming the door. And then her son came in looking upset, and she said, "What's wrong? What happened?" And he said, "I beat him." And it was the first time he'd ever beaten his father at tennis, and the father had a tantrum.
Wow. And then
another boy told me how he was racing his father along the beach, somewhere on a tropical island in Queensland, and he said, "I started to hear this panting and puffing behind me, and I looked around and I realised my father was falling back, and he was red-faced and he couldn't keep up. And I thought, my God, I'm going to beat him." And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "I beat him," and he was furious, and he hardly spoke to me for 2 days afterwards. And another boy was listening to this, and he joined in, and he said, "Yeah, I was playing my father at tennis again during the holidays, and suddenly I was leading 5-1, 40-15. I thought, my God, I'm going to beat him." And I said, "What happened?" He said, "I double-faulted, lost that point, lost the next 4 points, whatever, 3 points, lost the next 6 games, lost the match." And I thought, wow, what an interesting contrast between the two reactions. And this was all in the space of 3 minutes. I heard these two stories, and I thought, one boy is more likely to go on and have a successful adult life, because when the time came to get out from under the shadow of the parent, he had the courage to do it. But the other one collapsed and couldn't do it, which means that he's likely to be overshadowed forever. And since I started noticing this, I've been asking men, you know, "Did you ever beat your father at anything?" And what a stories they tell. They nearly all seem to have a story of how they either failed or succeeded when that moment came. Mm. And you read autobiographies like memoirs of particularly some of the British memoirs of men who were growing up and were watching their father beat up their mother every week or so. Mm-hmm. And eventually the time came when the son steps in between the father and mother and says to the father, no more, that's going to stop. And at that point, the father will either collapse in a rage or he'll go down the pub and have more drinks or he'll beat up the son. Mm-hmm. And what happens at that critical moment, I think, is absolutely crucial to the future of the relationship and the future of that young man. Mm-hmm. So they're just a few examples. I think with mothers and daughters, it's more complicated. And with fathers and daughters and mothers and sons, but certainly with fathers and sons, I think there is quite a easily readable, tangible, discernible time when they do have to have this standoff. And it can be very amicable. With a good father, it can be done graciously and generously and warmly, where the father might say, good on you, you beat me at last, I knew you would one day, and that's really well done, congratulations. Mm. Because I think their own mortality starts to become more tangible for them, which is a shock for anyone, of course.
Mm, absolutely. I think mine was probably the old drinking and partying and that kind of thing back in the youth, but I feel like the coming back to the parent didn't happen until motherhood. You know, you go away in your youth and you become who you are, and it's not until you become a parent again, I think, that there's that understanding and the compassion and the forgiveness perhaps of parenting mistakes, as we all will. None of us we're all human. We're all going to make terribly awful parenting mistakes. Yeah. But that compassion to understand that, oh, yeah, now I get it. Now I understand.
Yeah, and children are infinitely forgiving as long as they know that you do love them deep down. Mm. If they aren't sure about that, then you've got a real problem. But you can be bad-tempered, you can be nasty to them at times and so on, and they'll get over that without any great difficulty. As long as the foundations are good. But if the foundations aren't good, then, yeah, it's a fraught situation.
Absolutely. Well, taking up an entire hour of your time here when I was only going to take up half an hour. So I'd love to just thank you for being a voice for children. You know, they too often go unheard, and also for encouraging these uncomfortable conversations that I think we as Australians are really terrible at. So for writing a piece like this and opening up that conversation, I know amongst our Wildlings family, your book has been passed around and around, and it's opened up some really deep and meaningful and wonderful conversations about the way that we parent and the things that we can do to change. So thank you for your bravery in publishing something like this. I can't imagine how it felt to hit the final send button on it. So my husband actually read it. He's an ex-teacher, and he said, you know what I love the most about this? There was a level of I don't give a sh about it, and that this needs to be heard. And I really appreciate that for Australia's children, essentially.
Thanks, Nikki. I love what you're doing too. This sounds like a mutual kind of love society. But I've seen the videos of Wildlings and the work you're doing, and I think it's absolutely right. That's just a fantastic concept, and it's being put into practice in a fantastic way.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have had the chance to talk to you.
If you'd like to find out more about Candlebark, John's work, or where to find his latest book, The Art of Growing Up, just head to our show notes at wildlingsforestschool.com/raising-wildlings and then look for episode 12. And don't forget that we also have some free downloadable gifts for you on the website to help change the way we speak to our children and to help us spend more time outdoors. Our latest offering is a guide on what to say instead of be careful when your children are engaged in risky play. So to grab your copy, head to wildlingsforestschool.com/free-downloadables. Next week, we'll be talking about our little baby, Wildlings Forest School. We'll be talking about what Wildlings is, our aims and purposes, how we plan to change the education system from the inside out, and why this is so important for Australia's children. If you've loved this episode, please make sure you subscribe to the Raising Wildlings podcast on your podcast platform of choice and share your aha moments with us on social media. We hoped you enjoyed hearing from John, one of Australia's favourite authors, as much as we enjoyed chatting with him. And until next week, stay wild.